And welcome back to Dad's on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and with me in the studio today is Ken Thompson.
Hello, everybody.
And our guest today first came to public attention in the 1980s, courtesy of The Mike Willesey Show. A young director, Aviva Zilger, was putting documentaries together and was intrigued by Quentin's story when he was only age 7. In his new book, Not All Superheroes Wear Capes, our guest today, Quentin Kenahan, reveals that there have been a whole lot more stories in the following 34 years. Quentin, welcome to the program.
Morning, Bill. Morning, Ken.
Good morning.
So, Quentin, why do you think you did get such a huge reaction from that the national audience when you first appeared on our TV screens?
You know, I honestly don't know. It's a question that I've often asked myself. I think it was just the right time in television history. No one had seen, no people with disabilities had really been represented on television up until that time. And I guess it was, whether it was the cute factor or whether it was curiosity, somehow that story connected with people and it was watched by pretty much half the country.
Yes, look, that's right. It was a long time ago, but it's amazing how everyone remembers what they were doing when that show was on. And, of course, now your face is beaming out from bookstores all around the country.
But, it is.
When you went on that television show, did you enjoy talking to Mike Willesey?
Not really. I was just a 7-year-old boy wanting to live out his life, and at the time I was in America going through some pretty traumatic stuff, and the last thing I wanted to do was talk to some nosy journalist. So I kind of gave him a bit of attitude at the time, but it all turned out well in the end.
Well, it certainly did, but I suppose you then became a bit of a celebrity in your own circle. So, what was the reaction like when you went back to school after all that?
Mixed, yeah. Honestly, some thought it was cool, and some thought it was, I don't know. There were mixed reactions to it. You know how kids can be with tall poppet syndrome and all that. So, you know, some were for it and some were jealous of it, so you know, it was a bit of a mixed bag.
And there was no doubt an effect within your own family too. How did your parents and your siblings react to it?
Oh, my parents loved it. You know, they were happy with it because it furthered their career as well, and I think my siblings just wanted it all to go away.
Your sister, Sia, in particular, was a bit wary of all the publicity, wasn't she?
And she still is. She hasn't changed a bit. She always thinks that I overshare. But, you know, she has a very private life, and so does my other siblings. So, you know, that's the life they want to lead.
Well, in your book, you reveal much about your own feelings, but also all your relationships with your family. Were you concerned at all about exposing perhaps too much about the family dynamics?
I was, honestly, but I warned everyone that it was going to happen, and I gave everyone the ability to put input into it, and my mother certainly did have input into the book, and whilst she's not happy with some of it, she understands the reasons why certain aspects of the book are there. Certainly other things were withheld, but you know, everyone had the opportunity to take part, and out came the final product.
You talk in some parts of the book about how you were angry with your parents for different things they did. I mean, I think when they took you to Regency Park, that didn't seem to have a, happy outcome for you.
No, it wasn't a good time in my life, and you know, it took a lot of self-searching to come to terms with that. And part of the reason why I write that in the book is to not sort of blame my parents or, you know, point a finger at them, but to show that parents make mistakes too, and that, you know, they're just humans trying to make best of an impossible situation that they were placed in, and they had to make decisions, and some of them were good and some of them were bad, and some of them had good outcomes and some of them had disastrous outcomes, but it all makes up a life.
I was intrigued. I mean, they made an extraordinary decision in support of you to leave Melbourne, to uproot from Melbourne, where you had a home and everyone was settled, and then strike out again in Adelaide because you were the one that needed the medical treatment. I thought that was a major sacrifice, really.
Yeah, it was, and you know, it was something that nearly tore the family apart, because my mother and father were at odds about this, but ultimately it ended up being the right decision. Yeah, because, you know, we eventually made a home here, and we found happiness, I guess.
Well, you're still in Adelaide, aren't you? So you must have connected with the other city.
Yeah, this is my home now. I love Adelaide. Mm. And it's not as though I haven't tried to live other places. Like, I talk in my book about living in Queensland, and I lived for a short time in Sydney. But, you know, home is where the heart is, and my heart is here in Adelaide.
And did you find, with your parents, the whole family making that big sacrifice in a way, I mean, in the end it turned out well, but initially it must have been a sacrifice to move to Adelaide. Did you find that that created problems with your siblings as well, that perhaps you were getting all the attention, which seems to often happen in this situation?
Yeah, and that was part of my parents' reasoning to put me in Regency Park in the first place, was the fact that my other siblings weren't getting enough attention and they were feeling left out, so they felt that they needed to focus on the other siblings in the family for a while.
And then with your parents, as you said, you just mentioned then, it did create problems between them, and I think ultimately they finished up separating, didn't they?
Yeah, they ended up getting divorced in about 92, 93.
So when you look back now, when you look at your father, for instance, you know, who had his own personal problems, but how do you feel about him when you think back on your father now?
Oh, he's a good bloke. Yeah, you know, he was definitely what you would call a larrikin. You know, he was, he smoked 2 packs a day, didn't mind having a drink at the bar and telling yarns till the cows come home. And that's pretty much what I remember about him, and him teaching us how to write. And he would always share stories of the past and give us life lessons, as he would call them. Yeah, he would get one of us up at 5 o'clock every morning. It was either me and my brother or my sister, and he'd just talk about the world and what was going on until we had to go to school, and there's some of the best memories I have.
Of course, he was a journalist, so that no doubt influenced you in your career in the arts.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he taught us how to write and how to construct a paragraph. And neither of my parents were very good at mathematics, so I can't say I was very good, but I always did well in English because of it. I was being constantly pointed out for bad grammar and, you know, things like that. So, you know, they had their strengths and weaknesses. Yeah.
So we're speaking with Quentin Kenahan, who is the author of a new book called Not All Superheroes Wear Capes. And I think your mentor and friend Russell Crowe would put you into that superhero class, Quentin. But because of the condition you were born with, you've broken something over 1,000 bones. I think the description was over 1,000 by the time you were 21. And that, no doubt, has led to some of the problems you've had. You've described the depression and the downsides, but then all of a sudden you bounce back and you talk about having a new zest for life. Is this something you were born with, this inner resilience, do you think?
No, I don't think you're born with it. It's either fight or flight, I guess. It's like that line from Shawshank Redemption, you either get busy living or get busy dying. You've got to make a decision whether you're going to accept your lot in life and just roll over or turn and give it a good hot try. And I knew that I wanted something different for my life, and I didn't want to just survive. I wanted to live, and so I came up with this list of goals that I had and slowly but surely went through them.
Well, it is an extraordinary life, and it's so well documented in this book that, the number of celebrities that you've been involved with, I mean, very few people get to meet all the people that you have and to have some of those experiences, do they?
People make a lot of light about the celebrities that I've met, and I reckon the celebrities are great, but they're not as interesting as some of the actual people I've met in my life. Being a celebrity is an interesting job, but I wouldn't say it's a great life. I think the people around you is what makes life great, and I've fortunately been around a lot of lovely people, and like you said, some of them happen to be celebrities, but I think I've been fortunate in the connections I've made with a lot of people, whether they're famous or not.
And I guess that's what comes to mind, is that one of your extraordinary abilities is the networking. The way that you were able to, I don't know, to change, say, from that initial interview with Mike Willacy to then go on and to be to meet all the people in the film industry, because you decided that's where you wanted to go. All of a sudden, you know, you're meeting these people, they're doing things for you, you're contributing. I mean, is there a secret for networking? Do you just need that internal confidence to get out there?
It's that, but it's also realizing that they're just people as well, and that you don't have to idolize them when dealing with them. You can just deal with them as equals and as regular folk. I think too many people treat celebrities on a pedestal when they're just people, and they just want to be treated as regular, everyday folks. So when I talk to people, I don't use Mr. or Mrs. or Sir or whatever. I just, when I first met Russell, it wasn't hello, Mr. Crow. It was g'day, Russ. How are you? You know, it's that kind of thing. It's bringing everything down to a human level and making an actual human connection with something, with someone, you know, and I think that's what I try to do with everyone I meet, including you and Ken.
Well, that's good. I think I feel like you must have felt in when you were speaking to people that you particularly identify. You talk about Bert Newton and Julia Gillard, and that I think you were nervous for different reasons when you spoke to both those two.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're both very intelligent people that have gained a lot of wisdom from their experiences, and wanting to learn from those experiences and tap into what has made them successful can be nerve-wracking. So, yeah, I was a bit jittery when I met both of them.
Not so much with Ray Martin. You immediately sort of related to Ray Martin?
Oh, but I've known Ray since I was 10 years of age. You know, so I've known him since I was a little tatter. So initially our relationship was of an adult and a child, but as we grew, or as I grew and as my experience grew and our friendship grew, it became more of an equal standing, and now I can call him a great mate.
Which, yes, not that many of us can do. But no, look, I love the story when Russell Crowe first got in touch with you. I wonder if you could tell us about that.
Well, I was very down, and I was in hospital, and I was tweeting out very dark things because I'd just been told that I'd have to wear oxygen permanently forever, and I was very dark about it. And I was being very dark on social media and talking about suicide and all these types of things, very depressed. And Russell Crowe rang me, and I picked up the phone. I said, "Oh," and he says, "G'day, mate, it's Russell Crowe." And I went, "Yep, sure is, mate," and I hung up. And the phone rings again. And he says, "Mate, it's really Russell Crowe." And I said, "Prove it." He says, "My name is Gladiator." I thought, "Holy heck, we've got the Gladiator on the other one."
Yeah.
I said, "What do you want, mate?" He said, "Mate, I'm a bit worried about you." And I went, "Right, and how did you get my number?" He says, "Mate, I'm the Gladiator. I can do anything." I thought, fair enough. And so he just said, "Look, you're going through a rough patch already, but, you know, if you're going to die, just deal with a bit of dignity and shut up about it." And I went, "What?" And he went, "Mate, we all know you're going through a bad time, right? But there are many people that give a damn about you, and you're not counting that. You're just brushing it over." He says, "If you want help, just ask for it. There are heaps of people out there that will help you and that care about you, and I'm one of them. So if you need help and you need a friend, you know, just let me know." And he did help me out. He motivated me. He helped me get a film made and, you know, introduced me to George Miller, which got me my role in Mad Max. And as they say, the rest is history, and now he's a great mate.
Yeah. Well, just talking about your role in the Hollywood blockbuster, which I think had been an ambition of yours from a young age, but you probably didn't expect to get a part as Corpus Colossus in the movie.
Oh, mate, I had no idea. I had no idea. I got a phone call from my manager, and she said, "Oh, Dr. George Miller wants to talk to you." And I went, "Okay, fair enough." And sure enough, the next day he rang me, and he spoke to me for like 40 minutes. And we didn't talk about a film or, you know, anything to do with Mad Max. And he said to me, "You know, it's been really great talking to you, Quentin." And I said, "Are you guys going to offer me a part in the film, or was this just a social chat?" And he said, no, you know, I'm already talking to your agent about you being in the film. We're going to see you in 2 weeks." It's like, oh, my gosh. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, my whole body was shaved top to tail, barring my beard. And I was in a makeup chair getting tested to be in Mad Max. It was crazy.
Oh,
it's got my life,
though. Yeah, look, it must have been, and particularly, you know, when you've sort of had that fantasy for a long time. But you yourself are a filmmaker, and I'm just going back to the other side of things, but do you think all those experiences of depression and loneliness and fear and pain that you've had, the constant pain, do all those things help make you a better filmmaker, do you think?
I don't think so. No, it does make me a more understanding person. But it also makes me less empathetic at times, though, as well. Sometimes if people have a stub their toe or scrape their knee or little things, I find it hard to have empathy for people who whine about little injuries. Mm. And I should have empathy, but sometimes I'm a little bit, come on, get over yourself. You know?
Yes, coming from you, I'm sure that would have a big effect with some of the prima donnas in the industry. So,
you know, my disability has taught me resilience and patience. if anything. Perseverance.
Well, there are a couple of things, the perseverance and the inspiration. I think people can draw a lot out of your book, which just, again, is called Not All Superheroes Wear Capes. Quentin, you've got a bucket list at the end. Do you recommend bucket lists for people?
Sure do. I certainly do. I think you've got to have goals in life, and they can be the most outlandish things you've ever thought of. But as long as you've got them and you're determined to go after them, I think they're helpful because it helps keep you focused, it helps keep you healthy, and it keeps you motivated to keep wanting more. Too many people get themselves in a rut and they settle, and you end up surviving and existing rather than living. And to me, there's a big difference. And I don't want to ever just exist or survive. I always want to go out there and live every moment. And that's why I constantly strive for things to do and goals to achieve. Because it keeps you going, keeps you dreaming.
So if people want to know what our guest Quentin Kenahan's bucket list is, it's in the book, and you also say stay tuned. So I'm curious to see what's going to go on the next bucket list. But Quentin is now 41. He's achieved so much as a disability activist, a filmmaker, a stand-up comedian, a radio host, a film critic, an author, and other things as well. But Quentin, I just wanted to thank you very much for being on the show. We get to this stage where we ask our guests to pick a song. We're wondering if you'll be okay if we play a bit from your movie, the Mad Max.
Mate, I'd be honoured if you played something from the Mad Max soundtrack. That'd be great.
All right. Well, here we go. Mad Max Fury Road. This is Brothers in Arms by Junkie XL. And that was Brothers in Arms by Junkie XL from the soundtrack of Mad Max Fury Road. And we have a star from that movie with us today, Quentin Kenahan. Quentin, once again, thank you for being on the show. And we wish you...
Thank you both. Thank you both. And the reason why I wrote the title of the book is Not All Superheroes Wear Capes. I want people to realise that there's a superhero in all of us. Everyone has that one superhero moment in their lives. And you just have to harness it and create more. And I hope by reading the book, people realise that and go and become their own superheroes.
I hope so too. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. If you go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email, we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show with our guest Quentin Kenahan again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter.
I am on the website right now. It's very cool.
Thank you, Quentin. And we'll be back next week with another show.